cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon is present as always. How are you, Whit?
Yeah, I'm all right. A bit of crazy traffic today, and I don't know how you made it to studio. Isn't there a ban on Arabs or something like that?
Only in the US. But not yet, as far as I know. Everyone's welcome, except the Dalai Lama.
And that homophobic preacher.
Yes, but tinpot dictators accused of genocide, please come on through.
No problem. We will take them.
We are
very welcoming as South Africans.
Very much so.
Very welcoming.
Maybe too welcoming to certain people. But yeah, I mean, Trump's banning all Muslims from all Muslim countries.
All Muslim. Apparently, he hates minorities. Even though Muslims are in the majority worldwide
as a
religion.
That's the biggest religion in the world.
Anyway, I'm sure we can get into some of the Trump stuff. As you can hear, we're not freaked out by it, although I think his ban is wrong, for what it's worth. But I'm not going to get quite as hysterical as some people online have. But this is the ill-fated recording that we recorded once, and I don't know what happened. The communists got to it. And unfortunately, for some reason, we just didn't get it.
And then we tried to record the second time, and then there was systems failure once again, hacked by the Russians.
Yeah, well, of course. They don't want this out there.
No, they don't want to hear us. And now, third time lucky, and if this doesn't record, I'm going to shoot myself.
Yeah, same here. Well, we'll just release it without the recording, and people can fill in the blank spaces.
It's postmodern art, man.
That's what it is. So our guest today is Russell Lamberti. He is the MD and chief strategist at investment advisory firm ETM Analytics. Russ, thanks so much for joining us, third time lucky.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's good to be here. I think we'll get this one done.
Very, very much hopeful.
Right. I mean, I think it's
pesky Russians, eh?
Well, I think it's important for people to know that Russell is an economist, so it's just above being a priest, I think, in terms of prophecy. But nevertheless, Russell, so South Africa, you know, the southern tip of this continent, we are seen as a very important economic power. I don't know where. But how are we doing on the economic front, at least?
Yeah, look, I mean, South Africa's been struggling for quite a long time. You know, I think that we've got a government making decisions at a very high level, and those decision makers, I mean, you know, governments around the world at the best of times don't really understand economics and how to make an economy grow, but in South Africa that problem seems to be particularly chronic amongst our leaders and policymakers here. For at least 10 years or so, we've been in a kind of macroeconomic stagnation, very, very little economic progress of any meaningful sort of description. And I think that our economy on the whole is fragile, is probably a little bit brittle.
Yeah.
Hasn't maybe suffered from quite as much hubris and exuberance as we've seen overseas in the last number of years on the big money printing bubble. So maybe that's a little bit counting in our favor. We've sort of maybe sidestepped some of that a little bit. But lots of big challenges for SA's economy, and not doing ourselves any favors by the policy mix that we have here domestically, which we can get into.
Yeah, well, I'm going to throw the question out that Ramon asked you previously, which was, tell us why our communist finance minister, who everyone seems to love, is such a bad idea. And as you've mentioned, over the past 8 years, 8 to 10 years, we've really stagnated. And of course, there have been excuses like, the 2008 economic crisis, and there's all kinds of wonderful excuses, not disinterest in foreign direct investment. People love comparing us to the other BRICS countries. But tell us why Previn is not the gift that everyone tells us he is.
Yeah, look, I think it's actually a very important question because it goes to the heart of the political economy situation in South Africa at the moment. You know, we currently have a struggle between this idea of state capture, kind of corrupt, cronyist administration, you know, headed up by Jacob Zuma, contrasted with the enlightened, progressive, cabal, which Pravin Gordhan is essentially the poster child of. And of course, it all came to a head in that Nene Gate scandal with the sacking of Hlanhla Nene, and then, you know, through a whole drama and saga over a weekend, Pravin Gordhan was reinstated as the finance minister to great fanfare. And of course, he's been able to use this complete lack of confidence in the Zuma administration and juxtaposing himself against that administration to sort of paint himself in a very good light. But I have to say that I think that him and the sort of socialist communist cabal that has basically usurped so many of the key policy making functions are really playing a very clever game of public relations management here, because they've really been at the helm and steering the ship under the Zuma administration. In fact, Zuma, in particular, as a president, is quite deferential to these SACP socialist policymakers. He's let them basically have free rein and kind of do what they want. And now that they've got a chance, they see they're on a sinking ship. They will never admit that it's because of their policies, but they kind of see a way to sort of sidestep the blame by jumping off the Zuma ship, so to speak. We can get into the specifics of how the likes of Pravin Gordhan and Rob Davies and Ibrahim Patel and these sorts of guys have got us to where we are today. But, you know, make no mistake, Pravin Gordhan has been right in the thick of the policy mix, you know, of the last 10 years or so. And, you know, being in the fiscal position, being the Minister of Finance, managing, revenues and expenditures, he's overseen a dramatic increase in South Africa's debt. South Africa's debt levels have ramped up, and really, as we now stare down ratings agencies and face potential ratings downgrades, Pravin Gordhan is one of the architects of this policy and is surely at least one of the key people to blame for getting us into this predicament.
So, Russell, if you have to name, not to get too specific, but name two or three policies that he has formulated or that he has implemented which have caused, you know, a more general sense of poverty in South Africa.
Well, look, I mean, if we had to go back to 2008, 2009, when Trevor Manuel handed over to Pravin Gordhan, he was instrumental in starting to ramp up the deficit spending after the balanced budget era of Trevor Manuel. Now, you know, I don't like to make this too much about the personalities and the specific people. Trevor Manuel, yes, he ran balanced budgets, but he did it at a time when global conditions and domestic conditions were very, very favorable for him to do that. So he kind of got lucky, and Pravin Gordhan took over when things had reversed dramatically. You know, the commodity super cycle was coming to an end. Economy was in recession, global economy was in recession. And of course, the policy du jour back then was deficit spending. Ramp up the fiscal deficits. Governments were borrowing all over the world. The US went into big debt, UK, European economies as well. So he was very much part of that, but I think, you know, he ran with it, he embraced it. And I think key is that he was never able to bring it down and reverse it again, substantially anyway. And so we sit with this legacy now of year after year, huge deficits. So I think that's got to be a very important factor that Pravin Gordhan has, that's a big legacy that he's had. I mean, I think the other thing to say from a fiscal perspective is that we've basically over the last number of years, we've increased the tax burden. We've raised tax rates. We've made capital gains taxes more burdensome. We've just generally raised taxes stealthily in some ways, more explicitly in other ways, across a range of taxation areas, whether it be income tax or capital, you know, investment taxes and so on. So, I mean, I think that's clearly a problem. I mean, South Africa is not the kind of economy that can withstand these sorts of increases in regulation and taxation. So those would be just some examples, some fairly obvious examples. And then, you know, I think that, you know, more broadly, Pravin Gordhan is fundamentally a statist and a big developmental statist. And that is a kind of Marxist term that refers to this notion that government is the key heart of economic development. It's the antithesis of a sort of a classical liberal, typically, you know, historically Western understanding of economic development, where you have a dispersion and a diffusing of economic activity and of decision-making power, and you allow much more freedom amongst actors in the economy to participate. Why I'm kind of going into this is to say that, you know, when you're steering a big fiscal ship, these kind of big ideological positions matter. And Pravin Gordhan, every year he gets up, if you just listen to his language, the language that he uses, of the language of development, there is very little chance with him and his cabal at the helm that we're going to get any kind of meaningful fiscal turnaround in this country. That's why for so many years now, when economists keep giving Pravin Gordhan 6 or 7 out of 10 at the budget, we continue to give him 3 or 4, because even if he's able to tweak, you know, some budget line items to sort of make things look okay, he's not fundamentally turning the ship around. He fundamentally believes that the state, specifically the ANC, should be tasked with playing God in the South African economy and directing all forms of development. So this is, I think, ultimately massively detrimental to South Africa's economy.
Yeah, I would tend to agree, because once you give the state a lot of power to run the economy, well, that's what happens when that causes corruption, right? There's a lot more lucre to be spread around. So arguably, Pravin and his ilk can be the reasonable cause of the state capture as we know it now of, say, the Guptas, right? If the state has 700 state-owned enterprises, that money has to flow somewhere, and why not to friends and family?
Yeah, well, I mean, the communists that are running many of these key economic nodes are painting themselves as these sort of anti-corruption warriors, but they are utterly delusional, because corruption follows a big government like night follows day. You know, they want their hands in all the pies of the economy. They want to control trillions of rands worth of economic activity every year. They want a decision, you know, they want to say in everything from who you can hire to how you can hire them to the terms and conditions upon which you can hire them, to how much you can pay them, to the color of the skin of the person you need to hire. I mean, these guys want control at every level, and then they are saying, well, you know, it's quite a pity that you know, our national democratic revolution has been derailed by corruption. I mean, corruption is the only result, the only thing that can result from a national democratic revolution, where you essentially try to dominate the entire developmental space with the state and with all the power, lawmaking power, cronyism that can potentially result from that. So I mean, it's just quite funny how they think that they have a chance of being non-corrupt when the very essence of what they're doing can only lead to corruption.
All right, so then I'm going to ask, if we move laterally then from that point, which is, I see on the weekend there was one particular article which said that Brian Molefe is waiting to basically be appointed as the new finance minister, and Pravin is going to be removed. And obviously the comment on my feed on Facebook, which is generally people with their heads quite well screwed on, even though I don't agree with all of them, was, well, you know, this will be the terrible, absolutely catastrophic. And I sort of commented, well, while I don't necessarily disagree that it'll be bad, I don't see how moving from the communist to, well, I don't know, the puppet is much different. What do you think if that were to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that clearly there is now a bit of a, there's a bit of almost kind of game theory going on now with Zuma and the Treasury and Robin Gordon and investors, you know, the investment community. And, you know, there's now an expectation, there's now a meme that if Pravin is fired, that's bad for South Africa, and if he stays, that's good. So I suspect that if he is ousted in a cabinet reshuffle, you know, that might be, there might be an unfavorable reaction to that. Like, you know, I don't know if how violent it might be. We saw what happened at the end of 2015. We saw what happened, you know, at various times in 2016 when there was uncertainty around the Treasury position. And I think with good reason, because when a Treasury is captured for truly kind of corrupt, you know, or very directly corrupt political ends, and then, you know, that opens up the doorway to potentially the Reserve Bank being captured. And the minute you go that route, you're kind of going a Venezuela, Zimbabwe type route, where you're getting into the money printing game, which is disastrous. I mean, we're not there yet, but you can see why investors, you know, have a big problem with that, because that can be a very, very slippery slope. So as much as there's a socialist kind of communist cabal, you know, running the show now, certainly at Treasury in the form of Pravin Gordhan and particularly his deputy, Mcebisi Jonas, to the extent that they're in charge, but don't want to go the full Monty and kind of, you know, print money at the central bank.
The devil you know, then the devil we don't.
Yeah, a little bit like that. And I think to the extent that they don't go, you know, full capture and totally turn these institutions into outright, you know, corrupt fiefdoms. I agree that there's, you know, that we're probably better off with the one we have now than the one that may come. However, we also don't know that what may come is necessarily going to be worse. You know, it's not necessarily to say that we are going to get the kind of slippery slope that I'm talking about. And who knows, you know, maybe actually someone who's less ideological in that position might actually be a little bit better, someone who's maybe a little bit more open to persuasion, maybe a little bit more open to some, you know, some pressure from you know, business interest groups or, you know, who knows what. On the whole, I don't see how changing the finance minister, barring, you know, unless we go a real low road of crony capture, of, you know, total corruption of these institutions, we don't go that route, then I quite honestly don't see how, you know, getting rid of Pravin Gordhan is a huge catastrophe. In fact, he's brought us to a very precarious fiscal situation, and I think doesn't really deserve to have his position, if I'm honest. I mean, I think someone else at least deserves a shot at trying to turn this big debt juggernaut around.
Well, so fundamentally, your conclusion is Pravin has led us to a stage where, you know, we're on the cliff, we're on the precipice. If we carry on with him, it's an inevitable decline. If he's replaced, we don't actually know if it'll be worse. That's how bad we are at the moment. So, yeah, so keep Gordhan or change, but maybe it will cause Zimbabwean levels of hyperinflation if all those institutions are captured, as you said, for corrupt means.
Yeah, look, I mean, and the thing is that if the state, if the core of the ANC wants to go Zimbabwe, Venezuela, then, you know, Pravin Gordhan can't do much. I mean, he'll get sacked if he doesn't want to go with that plan. If he wants to go with that plan, he'll keep his job and he'll have to aid and abet that process. I mean, I just, you know, he does have power. He is a powerful position. He's a cog in the wheel, but he's quite a powerful cog in the wheel. because of his public relations efforts, he's a very good propagandist, and he's positioned him and the communists and the socialists quite well, even though he would refrain from defining himself as a Marxist or a socialist. He's part of that kind of group. So he's played the game cleverly, but ultimately, you know, it's so much bigger than Pravin Gordhan. This is, you know, about, I mean, really, let's be honest, this is about a ruling African National Party that is just corrupt and inept from top to bottom. I mean, this political organization is like a rotting corpse at the moment, and you know, some political analysts think it might not even be around in the next 10 years. It might be breaking up in the next few years. The chances of a big ANC split are bigger than they've ever been. So I just want to caution. So you're right, I think, in the way you summed it up. We obviously don't want to go Zimbabwe-Venezuela route. That's a terrible, terrible path. It's a humanitarian crisis, to say the least. But I also think that this is much bigger than Pravin Gordhan, and you know, we can slay any kind of dragon. We can slay the Zuma dragon or the Pravin Gordhan dragon or the SACP dragon, but the big problem is this big socialist African nationalism that resides in the ANC, this cronyism that resides in the ANC. This political unit has to just be shattered, and that's how South Africa, I think, is able to kind of constructively move forward.
But I mean, that's what we're doing with this podcast, Russell. We will be the ones to shatter the socialists from over here. Just wait till this podcast reaches 3-4-5 million people. But all right, so just
I might not live that long to see it, but hopefully.
You cut us deep, eh? You cut us really deep.
We're number one on iTunes, I'll have you know. So, Russell, last thing about South Africa, because that's the least interesting bit. So, the DA, right? I don't know much about their economic policies. They got a libertarian in the party to some extent. And he's running Joburg at the moment, and he's trying to clean up. We're not too sure how well he's doing. But do they have any policies that might help us? Should they gain power in the future?
Look, I think that the DA... I really I like a lot of the DA's liberal, let's even call it classical liberal, some of their classical liberal DNA, so to speak. I think that they've lost a lot of that, unfortunately, over the last 5 to 10 years. So I think the DA has gone from maybe a conservative classical liberal polity towards something that's moving a little bit more to the left, maybe a little bit more to the center and then to the left of center. And I think we're going to see more and more of that, because the DA is fundamentally playing the election game. It wants to win a national election. And to do that, you got to win the median voter. And the median voter in South Africa is low income, is black, and will be partial to, I think, just policies that have typically resonated with that base. And that's not generally the policies that have resonated with the DA's traditional kind of ethnic minority base. So the DA will have to live in contradiction a little bit. It'll pretend, in front of some constituencies that it's a classical liberal party. It'll have to sort of pander to some of these more populist positions. It'll to really embrace black economic empowerment when it was always historically against those kinds of policies. So it's just naturally going to morph into something that I probably won't like. I really don't love the DA, but I probably will dislike them quite a bit the more and more that they have to morph into this sort of Frankensteinian sort of political animal, full of contradictions and so on. It's a tough task. They're trying to win elections. Can they solve SA's problems? I think that could be quite effective, maybe at the municipal city level. Cape Town, DA seems to do quite well. Joburg's a big uphill climb, after many, many years of disrepair and mismanagement. So that's a tough one to fix. As a national party, I expect that they would be more liberal, and on the whole, I think they would govern this country, probably better than the ANC. But it's a tough country to govern, and they haven't really, there's no examples of them doing it yet. So, I don't place my hope particularly in the DA, but I do think they're clearly an improvement than, the rotting corpse that we have now.
Yeah, it's interesting some of the points you make, because I almost feel like there is a move, we've discussed it on the show before, in terms of their need to move more towards the left to try and pick up that audience or that voter. But at the same time, they sometimes make decisions which are illiberal, that they don't need to make. For example, stopping the sale of alcohol on a Sunday. That wasn't doing any damage, or they can't really prove that it was doing any damage. They've got this theory. We do want to get Helen Ziller in the studio. They've got this theory that, if you drink alcohol or you can buy alcohol on a Sunday, it means, that's the only way you would be able to drink alcohol on a Sunday, and somehow crime, violence, domestic abuse, etc. is all going to just go through the floorboards if that happens. That ban's been in place for a while now. I don't think anything's changed in terms of the crime statistics. And it does seem that they just pass things that sometimes don't make sense. So I'm not even sure it's an ANC versus DA issue. It's just some confusion.
I think South Africans are quite prone to some of these stupid illiberal policies. Even Herman Mashaba, the so-called libertarian mayor, who I, by the way, I think is great and I admire, but he was talking about the war on drugs, and the DA, of course, are big on the war on drugs down here in the Cape, and I think that this, ultimately that's very counterproductive. We've seen that globally. The ban on alcohol on Sundays, I suspect maybe they were pandering to like a conservative Muslim voter base maybe down here in the Cape. I don't know. Very hard to figure out why they pass stupid illiberal laws like that. So they are prone to doing silly things, the DA, and they're also, they've shown that they're quite efficient. And I talk about dangerous efficiency sometimes, because sometimes, when you've got an illiberal party that's also very efficient at implementing their plans and their policies, that can sometimes actually be quite dangerous and quite oppressive. So they're nannies. The DA are nannies. Helen Ziller is a nanny. Musi Maimane is probably also a bit of a nanny. They're nannies, and they're quite illiberal a lot of the time. So, they don't get my pulse racing, let's put it that way.
Well, let's get straight across then to illiberal policies. President Trump has taken power. We are speaking basically 1 week into his presidency, because he took the weekend after his inauguration off, and then immediately signed a whole bunch of executive orders, which have left people literally hysterical. I don't think anything he's done so far, just whether you agree or disagree, justifies hysteria. A couple of things that he's done. He's stopped funding going to U.S. government organizations who work in the international community. They aren't allowed to promote abortion or give abortions with U.S. tax money any longer. That's an old rule that Reagan brought in, and then basically the Republicans bring it in, the Democrats sign it out, the Republicans bring it back in. And then obviously the one over the weekend that's caused basically what all I could see on Twitter was a meltdown, a complete and utter meltdown. Of people just losing their minds, a protest at JFK, which stopped flights and a number of people from traveling, including Muslims, which basically, I just want to say that there's been a lot of misreporting. I know that this isn't necessarily part of our discussion, but there's been a lot of misreporting on this, because it's not a Muslim ban to start off with it. It's a ban on seven countries where the majority of people happen to be Muslim. You won't find many Jews or Christians in a lot of those countries, and there's a good reason for that. What Trump claims is the reason he passed the rule. They're hated and killed. Obviously, I think it isn't functionally an illiberal policy, but I don't think it's worth the insanity. You seem to have a slightly different view on Trump, a bit more sane of a view on Trump. Do you want to tell us that, and in an economic sense, where you think things are going with him?
Yeah, look, I think that the first point is that there has been massive hysteria. The reaction to this travel ban is, I think, disproportionate. But I would potentially see it in two ways. You know, the one is that I think it's been blown out of proportion, which I think it has. I mean, if you go and read the actual travel order, I mean, I think you have to read quite deep between the lines to infer a very malicious intent here on the part of the Trump administration. I mean, I think that they are trying to grapple with a problem that perhaps they don't fully understand. I mean, Jonathan, you and I might differ on this, but I think that a lot of the U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East over the last 20, 25 years has created a lot of the problems that we're now seeing in terms of refugees, very unstable countries that have allowed, in many instances, terrorists to take root. Funding streams between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have clearly been counterproductive. So there's a whole kind of foreign policy mess that, and all I see this travel ban is sort of just a fairly small extension of what we've already been seeing for a long time. I mean, he's only extended this ban onto countries that Obama had already identified as problem countries, so to speak. Obama himself stopped processing all Iraqis coming into the U.S. for 6 months in 2011. No outrage then.
And Haitians as well. He stopped a whole bunch of Haitian immigrants as well. Whether you find either right or wrong, both have done it.
Yeah, so I think the point to be made there is that outrage in mainstream media on, in Twitter, which is, let's face it, Twitter is predominantly a kind of liberal sort of, space. Outrage is much more when there's a Republican president than when there's a Democrat. The Democrats were anti-war when Bush was in power. Obama came in, they shut up, we didn't see war protests for 8 years, and now we've, now the protests have started again. So it's very partisan, but if it highlights for people some of these key issues, some of these liberal issues, and it's bringing these things to the surface, that's fine. I just think that I struggle with this absolute loss of any sense of proportion. It's actually important because when you get real problems, you don't have your outrage barometer is totally broken. I just think people won't have the correct mechanisms to know how to react to certain problems. I mean, if they think this is bad, they've got another thing coming, they've got another thing in store for the next 10 years, because the next 10 years of politics is going to be very, very messy, very, very volatile. So, I'm trying to encourage people to just calm down, try and understand the bigger context in which all this is playing out in. Trump himself has inherited a mess, a big mess across the spectrum. He's got a massive national debt that he's got to deal with. He's got a rogue, environmental protection agency that has gone absolutely crazy against, fossil fuels, and it's trying to regulate the hell out of, the fossil fuel industry. He's inherited a CIA that is arguably, got some serious institutional problems going on there. He's inherited, heavy banking regulations from Dodd-Frank that he's got to deal with. He's got wars on the go. He's got, he's just got a whole lot going on. He's got big refugee crises. And I think this 90-day travel ban is a bit of a way for his administration to try and sort of figure things out. I don't support it, but at the same time, I think that the hysteria about it is just misplaced, overdone, and I just can't indulge that. I just find it incredibly frustrating.
So, Russell, let's talk about his economic policies, because in essence, I disagree with him fundamentally. They're protectionist. Free trade has made the world a better place. And anyone who argues otherwise is just non-evidence-based. However, people were left behind, and we do understand that now. So are you in the same boat as me where I don't like his policies, but I sort of understand them in a way?
Well, I mean, I always understand political policies because if you understand political motives, you can and the political zeitgeist, you can understand policies. But, you know, I can understand in some ways Hugo Chavez's policies, but they're awful and they wreck a country. Look, Trump's actually a mixed bag, and this is what's not, I think, well understood. Look, I think overall he probably doesn't understand, almost certainly doesn't understand economics very well. His trade policies are poor. Well, his trade ideas. I mean, we haven't had any kind of firm policy yet. Other than that, he sort of scrapped the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which doesn't seem like a bad move to me. That was, I think, a 6,000-page, clearly over-regulated crony document, and he's going to angle for just bilateral agreements with countries, and I think may end up getting quite liberal free trade agreements with them. Certainly with the UK, that seems like it's on the table. So I don't want to jump to conclusions on trade yet. I mean, some of his talk is concerning, and I agree. Global free trade has been great. The reason why some people might feel left behind is either because they're not adaptive enough humans, or they've been let down by bad policy domestically, monetary policy, fiscal policy, which I think have led to stagnation in the United States, not because China has taken, you know, jobs or anything like that, but domestic policy based. And it's actually not a big mystery. When countries get saddled with you know, up to their eyeballs in debt, they grow slower. It's like a historical fact. You know, huge debt levels, slow growth until you wipe those away somehow. Either you have a debt jubilee, or you have you got to figure out some way, or you have a war. But you got to figure out some way to get rid of the debt levels. So. So, you know, and then you got to look at Trump's, you know, some of his more potentially good stuff, which is I think what he's doing in the EPA looks pretty good. I think he wants to halve the size of that organization, make it far less intrusive and meddling. And, you know, I think he wants to deregulate energy. We've already got some pipeline go-aheads, which I think is good. It's very good. You know, the more oil supply, the better. We need low oil prices. Obviously, you don't want to go and, you know, ruin the environment entirely by doing that, but there's some cost to anything we do, anything we extract in the world. And then finally, just to say, you know, he's tackling Obamacare, and he's going to tackle the banking regulations. Now, he's got a big challenge on healthcare, because Obamacare is not the only problem in the healthcare industry. It's it was a problematic sector before Obama, you know, created the Affordable Care Act. So he's got some difficult things there, but basically he seems to be talking in a much more free market direction on that, which I like. And same on banking. And I think that's probably what a lot of the stock market is reacting to as well. So, you know, if I sum him up in totality from an economic perspective, I think he gets business. He gets that business shouldn't be heavily regulated. You know, he gets the kinds of conditions that businessmen and women like to operate in. He's fundamentally kind of capitalistic in that sense, but doesn't quite understand the international business arena or trade arena. So he's not unambiguously bad. You know, I think he's, I think that there's nuance there. And I think on balance, it's not obvious that his policies are negative for the U.S.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting perspective because, you know, just citing some of those things, TPP that he's cancelled, that trade partnership is always cited as, you know, it's thoughtless, and now what are we going to do? I actually want to ask you a follow-up question on that. But, you know, the pipeline is immediately, the immediate jump is to pipeline equals destroy the entire environment, which it doesn't. A lot of the arguments around the pipeline is actually around where it's going to travel and traverse, which is actually a bigger issue for me in terms of private property rights, and government should compensate appropriately or bury the pipeline or do whatever they need to do. But on the just as a broader concept, stepping slightly away from Trump himself, and with these sort of you know, partnerships, so these trade deals, why do I need to have the government make a trade deal with another country? Why can't I just say, Russell lives in Cape Town, I live in Los Angeles, Russell has a book to sell, I want to buy it, Russell wants my money, job done. Why do we need to have the government, and why is that such a big deal? Is it because it gets broader than that, and Amazon wants to buy 3,000 books, or what is the need for these huge deals, which in my opinion seem to actually cut out the bottom end of the market?
Well, I think your question sort of answers itself. You don't need these deals. You know, countries don't trade with each other. People trade with each other. Businesses trade with each other. You just need, you know, unfettered access to be able to trade with whomever you like, wherever you like. The reality is, in any case, already that many countries trade with one another without trade deals. So, you know, I mean, there are not, you know, all however many countries there are in the world these days, you know, all 200 countries don't have trade deals with all 200 other countries. You know, it's actually many countries just trade without trade deals. So some countries, of course, just put tariffs in place as a sort of blanket measure across the board to whoever, you know, brings things into their countries. Some countries are very free trading countries. Your Scandinavian countries, Sweden tends to be very, very free trade orientated. But yeah, I mean, I think on the whole, trade deals are similar to, you know, big legislation internally that would regulate an industry. It's all about kickbacks, you know, crony backslapping and back rubbing, you know, who can, you know, political lobby groups, you know, all these sorts of things. So in these big trade deals, you've got all the industry groups lobbying for protection. You've got all the, you know, the whole political sort of game happens in these trade deals, and it's to the detriment of the consumer, and it basically just makes global trade more difficult. So yeah, I know, because the theory is very clear and the evidence is very clear, that unilateral declaration of free trade is actually the best trade policy. So even if the country that you're trading with wants to put tariffs and trade barriers on your products going to their country, if you just unilaterally declare free trade, so whatever they want to send you can come in freely, whatever you want to send out can go out freely. That is a net beneficial trade position. The reason why it doesn't get implemented is because of, I guess, politics and the political process, lobbying, the whole thing. People, you know, a lot of, you know, small lobby groups are very scared of free trade because it might undermine their position. People work themselves into positions of political patronage and favor, and then they work very hard to try and protect these trade deals. And that, by the way, is why you see some of this big outrage at the UK leaving the European Union, because there's a nice, cozy, protected structure there for the incumbent lobby groups. And the potential for that to unravel and for the UK to actually adopt free trade deals with either Europe or the US or, you know, many other countries, or different trade deal structures, that pisses a lot of these people off, and they sense that their turf is being, you know, trodden upon. But yeah, short answer is you don't need these deals. You just need a trade. I mean, Jonathan Wood can trade with someone else in Argentina freely. No government needs to be involved.
Yeah. Well, unless it's drugs and things like that, unfortunately. So, which I do disagree with. But
things like, you know, arms deals and things like that, I accept that there's some gray areas. But on the whole, we're mostly just covered in trade regulation that we absolutely don't need.
I want, I want to live in a world where I can order an M16 automatic assault rifle on the internet and arrives at my doorstep in 3 days. That'd be great, wouldn't it?
Well, you and a whole bunch of the people Trump is trying to ban from the United States would like for that to be able to happen.
Yeah, but I mean, the price of an AK-47 is cheaper than like a week's groceries in Iraq. So maybe we should just go there. That's my libertarian utopia right there.
You did try sell Somalia to me a little while back. But we found out the broadband wasn't as good, so we couldn't take the show there.
Well, not now. We've got fiber. But nevertheless. So, Russell, I mean, looking to the future somewhat, do you think the concept of these big like the EU and that sort of stuff, do you think those will exist in the future? Do you think the power, absolute power at the very top of the hierarchy as we see it today in terms of the nation state and these super continents, in a way, super regulatory bodies that control 500 million people, such as the EU. Does Brexit indicate that it's fragile, or that people just feel like they've got no more transparency or accountability in the way they vote? What is your view on that?
I think that I do have a big view on this, which is that I think that the nation state as we know it currently is on its last legs. I think it's dying. Now, what replaces it, I don't know. I'm not even saying that the nation state itself will cease to be. I just think that the way we conceive of the nation state and its functions is changing dramatically. And that's changing for, you know, many, many reasons. But some of the obvious ones are, you know, the radical decentralization of information, the radical kind of connectivity that we have globally now. So people are connecting across state borders. And because of decentralized information, people are able to make to coordinate things that we have traditionally required or asked of the state to coordinate, or somehow expected that they're the only ones who can coordinate. But suddenly coordination functions with technology are becoming, you know, increasingly possible. And so the whole definition of what the state is supposed to do for us, I think, is radically changing. And I think it's an underappreciated trend because people are just still stuck in their present modes of thinking about how, but, you know, we see the state as something that will always be in its present form forever. And that's actually a very unlikely scenario if you just look at history. So the nature of the state has always evolved, you know, quite dramatically through time. So, you know, if you think of Bitcoin, for example, it's a hugely subversive technology on the nature of government. It undermines the need for, or the ability for government to control money supply. It undermines the ability of government to control transactions. You know, we've just been talking about free international trade. It undermines the ability of government to regulate industries and sectors. And as more and more technology comes to bear, I think that the role of the state is going to change dramatically. So these huge regulatory bodies, these huge supranational organizations, even the United States itself, which is really just a massive agglomeration of, you know, 50 very, very diverse and big states. The United States as we know it may look very different as a political entity. We may get some breakaway regions. We may see, and we certainly, I think, are going to see the fragmentation of Europe back into its national constituencies. And you know, maybe even to subnational constituencies across the continent. And I think this is a very exciting trend. You know, I think that this, because it's at its core, it's being driven by technology and the lack of need to keep relying on these big centralized, sluggish, out of date institutions, quite frankly. So, you know, on the whole, I'm quite positive about that trend.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably true. We will see an evolution of the state. I'm interested also that I think, you know, I'm going to do what the left does and compare the EU to literally Hitler, because what he really wanted was a united Europe with him as its grand leader. And what the EU has is the EU as the sort of central government with the head of the EU as its grand leader. And I think people are fundamentally rejecting that principle of government in terms of where someone many miles away from me, and this is historical as well, from the Roman and the Greek Empire, that, you know, the Ottoman as well. Someone who is hundreds or thousands of miles away from me has no idea of my life and my the substance of my life controlling it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's incredibly foolish, really, to pursue these massive supranational regulatory organizations across huge swaths of land and massive, you know, huge populations. And there is a push. There is a push for sort of global governance as well. I mean, you know, there is definitely a push for more and more global governance. Even in the financial sphere, the IMF is looking to play, I think, a bigger role in you know, perhaps a global currency. You know, perhaps the IMF becomes the global central bank and sort of funds, you know, the Fed and they would love that. And so on. But the, you know, the record of these massive institutions and these huge entities governing millions of people, billions of people, is not a good one. And, you know, I just don't know who likes being, you know, who likes ceding freedom and sovereignty to these ridiculous bloated bureaucracies. There's just very little. Humans just don't like doing that, and there's very little democratic support for the European Union in Europe. I mean, on the whole, people, you know, it's, you know, some of the treaties in the European Union have been rejected by numerous referenda across, you know, various different countries, and on the whole, you know, I don't think Europe is a united continent in the same way that Africa is not a united place either. I mean, it's, you know, they might have similar skin colors, but they're very different groups of people with different cultures and different languages and different ideas about life, and that's what makes life so great. That rich tapestry of culture, and, you know, free cultures interacting across a continent like Europe is what made Europe so great in the 14th, 15th, 16th, 1700s. So what we've got now is not appealing. And I think is fundamentally being rejected across Europe as we speak. And I think it's just a matter of time. I mean, Brexit was a big hammer blow. And I think Brexit is probably the first nail in the coffin, really, of Europe. I don't see how that entity, that European Union entity and the Eurozone entity and, you know, the ECB and the Parliament in Brussels and all these guys, I just don't see how they bounce back from this. I think probably 5 to 10 years, you know, who knows, these are tricky forecasts, but probably, you know, it seems like 5 to 10 years, that entity is on the ropes big time and is possibly crumbled.
All right. Well, you, just to sort of round up, you did mention some e-currency, you know, Bitcoin. I know there are a number of them. What's your view on all of these? It seems that they're obviously unregulated, which is in some ways a good thing. But when hackers break in and steal all your Bitcoin, that also becomes a bit of an issue. And the price seems to be very fluctuant. Do you think that's the future of currency?
Yeah, I do think it's the future of currency. You know, unless some other fancy technology comes in and usurps that, which is always possible. But certainly for now, I do think it's the future of currency. I do think it will fluctuate quite wildly still until it's been adopted by most people. One of the things that gives currency stability is when they get sort of saturation in terms of adoption. And then you've got a lot of trust in that currency, and it becomes a very stable unit of account, very stable medium of exchange. I think as far as the cryptocurrencies are concerned, I think it's probably fair to say that Bitcoin is the only viable game in town. It's probably the best designed cryptocurrency, and it's got to market first. So its computing power and the distributed ledger is now so impressively large that it's got very good security from that perspective. Yes, you still can get your Bitcoin stolen and hacked, but increasingly you've got companies springing up, security services springing up around that I think will make that increasingly safe. And once that's very safe, which I think it just about already is, the only thing you really need to add to the Bitcoin equation is efficiency. It's already quite efficient, but in fact, efficiency is not necessarily the best word. User-friendliness.
Accessibility.
Accessibility and user-friendliness. So we need to create some good user-friendly interfaces on that Bitcoin architecture. And then I think we've got something that is incredibly viable. I think it's frightening to governments, and I think that they're already trying to strategically respond to it. They will try and regulate it, and I think it could to some extent be quite a battleground, quite an intense battleground, that control for currency supremacy over the next 5-10 years is going to be a massive, massive theme. And I think if you guys can speak to people who know a bit more about the subject than I do on it, I think that'll be great, because it is, I think, a really, really critical theme for the next few years.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with you on that. I've got I think a quarter of a Bitcoin given to me many years ago.
Rich, eh?
I don't know how to access it. You need a blockchain.
I think last time I bought a Bitcoin, app. I had one 128th of a Bitcoin.
You need like an app and something. I don't know how to access it. But
Very difficult.
You just leave it, and then in 50 years' time, it'll be worth not much or very, very much. Who knows? Who knows? But nevertheless, Russell, I think we've taken up far more of your time than we agreed to.
You're going on to 3 hours now.
Guys, it's been very enjoyable. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And if you want to, what's your Twitter? At Russ Lamberti.
That's right, yeah.
Right. And buy his book, When Money Destroys Nations, to explain hyperinflation. It's really good. I read it.
Well done. There we go. I've been bad on the board today.
Shocking.
Russ, thank you very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. That's it. You know where to find our show.
And next week?
Oh, next week is Jordan Peterson.
Oh Jesus.
But don't ruin it for us.
But that's why we say after the fact.
So next week is another great show. In the meantime, you know where to find us at Renegade_Report on the Twitter and on Facebook. You can like our page. You're welcome to swear at Ramon anytime you like.
And we tweet a lot more than Shaka Sisulu.
Yeah, and it actually comes from our own brains, not fed to us by Gwede Mantashe. So,
I must admit, if someone paid me $50 million, I would tweet whatever the hell they want.
Yeah, all right. So when you see the Renegade Report tweeting like Lena Dunham, you know what's happened. Thanks so much for listening, and we will catch you next time. Cheers. CliffCentral.com.